Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Social Capital, the Intersection of Money and Meaning, Part 2. So I would like to welcome everyone here to the club tonight. We have our panelists, which I'm going to introduce briefly. And I'll just tell you right now, our panelists tonight are Gary Bowles, CEO of Ziggy, Fiona Hovington from Collective Imagination, Kevin Jones from SOCAP, and Sarah Brooks from Hot Studio. I'll be giving you a short bio for each of them. But I'm very excited about this program tonight. This program is connected to the SOCAP conference, which is starting next week. So you can find out about socialcapital.org, I think is the website for that. But this program tonight is inspired by that conference, and we'll be giving you some insights into that conference. So anyway, as they say, without further ado, I would like to get into our program tonight. I'm going to ask a leading question for each of our panelists, give you a little bit about them, and then get started from there. But this is about social capital tonight, and we're going to find out what that means. There are some terms that some people may not be familiar with that we'll be exploring, and then we will open it up for audience questions about 6:40. I'm going to start out with Gary Bowles. Gary Bowles is one of the people who was very much connected with the founding and the implementation of SOCAP and was the person who introduced me to SOCAP. I'm going to start with Gary. Gary Bowles is the CEO of Ziggy, which helps to build communities of impact for its clients and customers using events and software. Gary serves as consulting producer or curator for events such as Google Zeitgeist, Google Atmosphere, Nokia's Idea Camp, Nielsen Digital Summit, and TED Corporate Events, and was a co-founder of SOCAP, the Social Capital Market Conference. Bowles also serves as acting CEO for eParachute, a new site launching this fall based on the work of What Color Is Your Parachute? So, Gary, I wanted to ask you as a lead-off, well, why are events like SOCAP so important for social capital, and what does social capital really mean?
Okay, well, so I actually am not probably the best person to give the definition because I think Kevin Jones has probably had more to do with the development of that that phrase than anybody else, although it was originally coined by a guy named Bill Meehan at Stanford University. So, but maybe just briefly, Kevin and I used to actually operate as a company called Collective Intelligence, where we try to be intelligent, but we wanted to actually be imaginative, I guess. So, we became enamored in the late 90s and early aughts of the idea of accelerating the flow of capital to good. And so the whole idea of capital that doesn't necessarily need to have a social impact is that it will sort of flow to the most efficient way for people to be able to get a return. And we became very interested in the ways in which capital could be more social, that it could actually have some type of need to have an impact. And so Kevin and I are both recovering journalists, and we actually met. There's a magazine that I helped to found called Interactive Week back in the mid-90s. And so we both became interested in this arena of how you could try to accelerate the flow of capital to good. And because we both had done magazines and events and that sort of thing, we started in around 2000 in trying to figure out ways to be able to help this arena to coalesce. And the way that events work is if you do them right, they can be silo bridgers. You can bring people from different arenas together under the same big tent, and you can get the kinds of collaboration that wouldn't happen in any other way. But you have to do them at the right time as an arena is developing. And having done technology magazines in the past, you know, you kind of have to catch it at the wave at the right time. And so it wasn't until, 3.5 years ago? That we realized that we started to see enough of the dialogue in this arena where we thought that we could do something. So when we started SOCAP, we thought, well, we'll get a couple hundred people together and maybe see if we can get them to come from different arenas and maybe get some of the sparks going. And the first event ended to be about 600 people, so, and it sort of took off from there.
Thanks. Well, Kevin Jones, I'm going to go to you next. Just to give you a background on Kevin, and Kevin Jones creates information businesses inside emerging markets. He believes that markets emerge in conversation as people try to explain and understand value. But this market is not like others he's been in, and that's what makes it more interesting and more important. The social capital market adds a dimension of impact, what your money actually does in the world before it comes back to you as a gain or loss, to the traditional risk and reward investment equation. Besides convening and founding SOCAP, Kevin is founder of Good Capital, a venture capital firm that invests in social enterprises. He's also a founder of HubBayArea.com. So, Kevin, what does the social capital thing really mean, and what is the intersection of money and meaning, as you guys have defined it?
Yeah. Well, you know, our event is a heretical mashup. Social capital existed and does. That's the stuff between people, and the capital market existed. So we called our event Social Capital Markets. Social capital, capital markets. Wanted to make both sides a little bit uncomfortable. We wanted to bring more, you know, this is our logo and tattoo for our coming conference meeting. But, you know, we're the money plus meaning, what does it mean to you? Is kind of an algorithm that we are asking at this conference. And we got about 1,200 people coming. And we think that actually the intersection of money and meaning are the entrepreneurs. You have the investors, and the meaning is where the money goes. So it's microfinance in the developing world, or renewable energy in an African village, or a grocery in a food desert in Hayward. That's where the meaning is, where the money is going that is doing some good, and the intersection are the entrepreneurs.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, our next panelist is Fiona Hovenden. Fiona Hovenden likes connecting blue sky ideas to on-the-ground action. By training, inclination, and experience, she's a researcher, psychotherapist, and entrepreneur. As co-owner of social innovation consultancy Collective Invention, she uses the research to inform the strategies, change processes, and future experiences that she and her colleagues design for clients. Her current interests are focused upon the capabilities for creating sustained change for individuals, groups, organizations, and consortia. She enjoys working with complex problems and integrating multiple types of data into practical, usable applications. She lives in San Francisco with her family and likes good chocolate and bad movies. So, Fiona, can you tell us a little bit about polycentrism and your particular track that you're chairing this year at SOCAP, and maybe a little bit about how you came to SOCAP?
I kind of wish I worked for Collective Imagination as well, actually. So if I can get online before anybody who's tweeting from this event, maybe by midnight I might be. I've had the great privilege of curating a track this year at SOCAP called Polycentric Solutions Local in the World. And it's kind of a tricky word, polycentric. It's big and it's uncomfortable. But Eleanor and Vincent Ostrom have done great work around this, and I've been sort of like a kid in a candy store trying to catch up with these ideas. But polycentric solutions are really, I think, those solutions where there's no one central authority saying what has to happen and no one central authority controlling information flow or sort of predicting deadlines or outcomes. It's really about where groups of people are getting together with different senses of expertise, but all engaged around one particular problem. So coming together to look at how do we mutually hold each other accountable and solve some of these wicked problems, the kinds of things that have been really, really intractable. So problems of poverty, problems of inequity, social justice, and environmental inequity. And just all of the sort of endemic social problems, which right now seem to be, unfortunately, pretty much everywhere in the world getting worse, as some of the trend data indicates, inequity is getting worse. So polycentrism is just, again, a way of different people with different expertises coming together and understanding that there's no one solution, there's no one way of working, and we have to kind of broker these messy, engaged processes together and figure out the answers. So in the track, we have We have different scales. So we have a couple of sessions where we're going to be talking about regions and sort of different actors in the regions, politicians, academics, business communities coming together to say, this is how we're actually going to solve the problems of our region. And then we have a session which is on the food system, but we're going to really focus on one neighborhood in the East Bay. We've got different actors there, community members and politicians and different nonprofits who've come together to say, all right, let's reclaim this neighborhood from some of the gang territory that's encroaching, and let's create a whole neighborhood of urban homesteads where people can have control and access to good food and control over the food that they grow, and they're hoping and planning to build a grocery store there with a commercial kitchen so that people can actually bring their own food and sell it to each other.
That's great. Thank you, Fiona. Our fourth panelist tonight is Sarah Brooks. I'll read you her bio. Sarah Brooks is the Director of Social Innovation at Hot Studio, a team of designers and engineers who work with social entrepreneurs, business leaders, innovative organizations, and emerging companies to help amplify their impact. She joined Hot Studio in January of 2011 to expand the practice of projects focused on social and ecological impact. Sarah is an experienced designer, specializing in the creation of products, services, and systems that support innovation and emergent collaboration. Over the last 15 years, she's worked with entrepreneurs and organizations on all scales, from startups to Fortune 100s. Clients have included Alter Eco, Charles Schwab & Company, CNET, Code for America, Contemporary Jewish Museum, Ford TV, Hoop Fund, Hoop Hub SoCap, NetSquared, Nokia, PopTech, The Rexpedition, Skoll Foundation, and Zinio, among many others. There's many others. There are more than that, too, believe it. We didn't have time for them all tonight. This year, Sarah is curating the Design for Social Innovation track at SoCap. So, Sarah, I was hoping you could start out by telling us what is your larger definition of design, and tell us about the design track this year at SoCap.
Sure. Kevin claims not to understand what design is, so I just told him design is everything that isn't chaos. That's the short definition. Maybe a little bit of a more fleshed out one is that design is a process, and as my colleague Danny Malik likes to say, it's a journey. And it's a journey of discovery in which we do creative problem solving, and it's sort of a right brain and a left brain combined activity. And, you know, in addition to solving problems and fixing things that are broken, we also spend a lot of time thinking about the future and how to envision better possible futures and how to create products, services, and systems for people that are going to work better for everybody. And I think that design is really, a business, in fact, is really just kind of waking up to the power of design because, you know, in products and services, everybody expects utility. Everybody knows, you know, technology is so ubiquitous in our lives. We expect things that work, and we don't really want to pay attention to that. What actually differentiates is an experience that has meaning and relevance in our lives. And designers are really great at creating those kinds of experiences and embodying meaning. So we're going to be exploring that in our track at SoCap and really looking at how best that design can support all these social entrepreneurs who have incredible vision and mission and things that they're trying to bring into being in the world. And we're going to break down the process of design. We're sort of taking an overarching look at all the major phases of design in each of the particular sessions. So we're going to deconstruct the process so that people who aren't familiar with it can get a better understanding of it holistically, although you can kind of dip in and out of any given session, and it'll sort of hang together as a whole. And each session will be exploring methods and frameworks for that particular aspect of design. So we'll start with the discovery process and research and qualitative and quantitative research. And then we'll look at how you actually synthesize research and begin to sort of make some meaning and sift through a massive amount of data and sort of prioritize and make some sense of it. And then from there, how you create concepts that are going to map to the needs that you've uncovered in your research and synthesis, and then how you go about prototyping those. And once you launch them, how you learn from the market.
Thank you. You know, you and I were talking this afternoon, and you were explaining, because I think some of us are having trouble understanding design, which we think is putting a nice color on something. Or can you talk about how it actually happened? Like you were telling me about Code for America. Can you tell me about how that works, how design changes social impact?
Sure. Yeah, it's right. Design is so much more than an object or an artifact. I mean, it really is a process. And I think we were talking about a project that we just worked on at Hot Studio with Code for America. They're a really great young organization there in their first year. Jen Palka, the founder, we love her. She's so talented. She's gotten a group of 25 technology fellows together, and they've engaged with 5 different cities. And their mission is to make cities work better for people. It's a great mission. And so they're all about open source, and they partnered with an organization that's called Civic Commons to create an application marketplace that's designed to democratize the field so that small open source players can compete for government procurement of apps alongside of really large entrenched players. And so we worked with them to think about, like, what's the right model for this? people working in government who they're getting sold, you know, from large vendors, the reasons why they should buy those products. But if they were to think about it like and use a system that worked like many of the other consumer systems that they would use, if they were looking for a great restaurant, they'd go to Yelp and they would look for peer reviews and ratings, and they would, you know, look to see what other people have to say about the experience that they had. So we adopted that model and applied it into this government application. So, I mean, that's just one example.
Hey, Kevin, did you have something to say about that?
No, I'm – no. I guess this is simple. Yeah. I'm learning what design is, and I'm working with entrepreneurs, and I'm seeing that it's really an important – thing in adoption of mm-hmm. technology in the developing world in a particular mm-hmm. way, too.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question that you can answer.
Okay, good.
So tell us about how SOCAP came into being and how this whole thing came about in the first place.
Hmm.
Maybe get a little closer to the mic if you don't.
Sure, yeah. As Gary said, we tried to do some convenings back around 2000 or so. And the big problem was there was no new money coming into the room, so we could get the same people in the room talking about what's not happening. And there wasn't a lot of appetite for that after everybody realized, oh, that's discouraging, let's go home. We figured, Gary and I, that there was a need for it somewhere around 2007, and we looked toward it. And the real need for it came in an email that was kind of interesting. There were two groups trying to get together, and they were trying to get two different views of what would cause this thing of putting your money together with your meaning or who you want to be, and what would cause it to take off. And one was set up by one large think tanky nonprofit, and the other was set up by another one. And they weren't talking to each other, even though they were convening about a week apart. And they like these day and a half sessions that get airless, where you just wonder how you can imagine, you know, a linear future that won't happen. And so I said, well, let me do a conversation map, just a Rosetta Stone between what you're saying should happen and what the other people are saying should happen. And they said, oh, that's a great idea, one of them said. The other one didn't respond. And so then he said, well, actually, you know, we only have 10 minutes for you. And then they got an email when I was in the Hong Kong airport on the layover, and they said, there's really no room for it. I said, you don't want to hear what other people who are not in the room are saying about the same thing? And they said, no, we have the right people in the room. And at that point, I realized, oh, that's spectacularly wrong and a huge market opportunity. Because, you know, you want only the right people in the room if you're, you know, a grain cartel and you're mm-hmm. fixing prices. Or you've just won World War II, no Japanese need to come, but we'll do it with the Russians and we'll do it with Churchill and we'll do it, you know, with those folks. You divide the spoils. But markets are based about including strangers that you don't know their value, but you figure out that they have value coming together. So markets are intentionally messy and bring in new people and new strangers. So we said, oh, nobody's doing it right. They're the entrenched people. We'll be a disruptive innovator, and we'll have a conference that invites people out of their silos to come together.
There's one element Kevin's leaving out that I need to point out. When you see these kinds of emerging, a student of emerging markets, because I've been in the tech field for something like 30 years now, and so what you see when emerging markets are coming together is that there's a lot of players that are in different arenas that all have similar sensibilities, but they don't know about each other. And they're starting to see that there's something changing, and they believe that there's a future that they can have some influence on, but they don't know who else is trying to bring about the same kind of change. And so there are unique people that often serve as the sort of maven function in the Gladwell mentality of being able to span across multiple arenas and be able to start to synthesize and introduce and connect. And Kevin is actually one of those rare connectors. The way that Kevin's brain works is he sees something he doesn't understand, and he goes about and asks a lot of people what's going on. And then he echoes those things to the next person and the next person. And eventually he's this carrier of this meme. And so the way that a lot of this came about was that Kevin had done this walkabout in this arena and met so many different people and was trying to essentially bring them together to synthesize the connections between them. And so the original interconnection of a lot of the people who came into the SOCAP arena was because they were working on these independent things, but Kevin saw the connections between them. So it's a the only way that I felt that this was really going to actually be able to come to some scale is if we then gave Kevin this playground of being able to have a place where he could actually build those connections in person between a lot of the different players.
I just want to say sort of as I went to SOCAP for the first time 3 years ago as an attendee, and as an ethnographer, it was just fascinating to me that there were these very different groups of people in the same place. I mean, there were people in blazers and chinos. Sorry. And people who are sort of doing work in all parts of the globe who just sort of just got off planes and were coming to sort of talk about what they were doing. And it was just fascinating to see that conversations were happening across divides that looked otherwise you would have not looked at these groups of people and thought they could actually converse together. It was really fascinating.
Well, can you tell us more about the local angle that you're bringing to SOCAP this year? And how does that work? Because there are people... Kevin, how many different countries are represented with SOCAP?
I heard yesterday that we had 70.
70.
70, yeah.
And so, Fiona, how does that all play out with something in Oakland?
So in our track, we actually have people coming from various parts of the world. I'm actually very pleased to see a couple of my speakers who are in the audience tonight who do work in Kenya. And so we have... We're talking about locations and locales, but very distributed across the world. And I think one of the really exciting things about this is that while taking local action is really important because it's a place where we can really see some impact and get some really immediate feedback for good and for ill, which is always good to move things forward. One of the things that the moment we're at now in history, we can actually network these learnings across the world really well. So I'm very excited about the fact that we'll have conversations in the rooms next week where we've got people from all over the world doing work really locally, but actually looking at the connections and seeing the patterns that are emerging across the world.
That's great. Well, Sarah, how did you get involved with SOCAP? And can you tell us a little bit about that and what was so exciting for you that's made you stick around and take on this role this year?
Sure.
And please talk a little closer to the microphone.
Okay.
All of you guys.
Okay. So 3 years ago, I was convening a meetup that was designed to explore the intersection between technology and social good. And somebody came up to me at one of those events and just said, "You're going to SOCAP, right?" And I'd never heard of it. I didn't know what it was. And got on the phone with Gary's wife, who was a producer at the time. And a week later, I was working on a media plan to make sure that all these sessions were going to be videotaped because I was just completely blown away at the variety and the caliber of people who were going to be showing up. It just felt like there was going to be so much to capture, and I wanted to make sure we could do that as best as possible. So that was year one, and then last year I continued on that path and advocated for the conference to be live streamed because I was hearing there were a lot of people internationally that wanted to participate. And so we put it together, but very quickly, and we had something like with absolutely no promotion, like 20,000 people the first day who were just tuning in. So we're going to do that again this year, and I'm really excited about it because I feel like we have the potential to have even a broader reach now that people know it's going to happen. So that was year two, and then I've been advocating for increased visibility in the role of design and helping these people get the adoption for their products. I'm just a giant cheerleader for social entrepreneurship, and I really want the entrepreneurs to succeed. And what I noticed the first 2 years was that they were very strong in business and technology. Usually the entrepreneurs had like a core discipline in one of those areas, and the weakest link was design. And as you know, I've stated I'm really an advocate of great design in the role of like getting that adoption and understanding how to shift behavior or change behavior. And so I just really wanted to bring that more into the forefront. So here we are, year three, with a track in design for social innovation. I'm really excited about it. We have amazing people that are coming to be part of this sessions, world-class people, designers making such a big impact all over the world with their projects. And they're all really excited to come, and they're... we're going to be doing office hours, and they're offering one-on-one consultations with entrepreneurs to give of their time. So a lot of support for the entrepreneurs. And we hope that funders will come, too, who want to learn more about design.
So, Gary, I had a question for you. You're involved in a lot of very high-profile, very cool events like Google Zeitgeist and with the Skoll Foundation and Nokia. How does an event like SoCap really make a difference and make an impact in the social capital arena?
Well, I think that was actually one of the things we were most concerned about, I guess, initially, was are you going to get a bunch of people together for 3 days, generate a warm glow, and have everybody, you know, go off to their separate corners. And I think we'd set at least a couple of goals or at least hopes. One of them is that you're going to create a platform that is going to have people across the silos who are going to find ways that they can collaborate together so you can scale the impact of capital. So if you've got foundations and corporations and venture capitalists, and they're all working in their own silos, and they're not looking at ways to be able to reduce the duplication, if they're not looking at ways to be able to find the consistency between what they're trying to, the impact that they want to have, then you're going to keep the ultimate value of the impact much, much lower. And so one of the first things we wanted was just to bring a bunch of these people into the big tent and mix and stir and see if then they would go off and collaborate together. And I think, you know, the first year it sort of started to come together, and I think most recently you're starting to see a lot of consortia, a lot of initiatives that are spanning across these different groups. The second one is that entrepreneurs get funded. Is ultimately, if the capital doesn't get applied, if you aren't building the right kind of dating service inside this infrastructure, then you know, you might as well go home, because you really need to have all this independent innovation has got to find ways to be able to get funded. And what you really want is that, again, those different capital sources are all partnering to be able to fund those entrepreneurs. And I think we're you know, again, we're seeing this much, much greater activity now than 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So, Kevin, can you tell us a little bit about the role of funders and about the people seeking funding and how it's different at a SoCap kind of thing rather than a traditional VC thing, and maybe explain some of the difference in the process here?
Sure. Well, we are having pitch sessions in a big way this year that we've never had. There are used to be investor circle events out in the West Coast, and there aren't any anymore. So we have, I think it's more than 90 social entrepreneurs that are scholarshiped who will be at the event. And these are, you know, world-changing people. There's a woman from Pakistan who's got a really interesting thing. The young girls there had to weave rugs all day long and didn't get to go to school. But now they're making handbags with their weaving, and they're making enough money that they can also go to school in the same amount of time. So she's coming, and she's bringing some of her bags, and they're really pretty exceptional. And so it's those sorts of people where, you know, the business subsidizes education and gives them more money. That's that kind of thing that can also offer a financial return to investors. So there are a bunch of accelerator programs where they're kind of like boot camps and different kinds of things, and we're working with the best of those. So the best of the Unreasonable Institute and of Echoing Green and of Slow Money and a lot of those folks. And so those companies have been, we picked, you know, they offered us a dozen, we picked two. And then groups from South America and Central America, from Agora, and just a whole lot of different places. And so they will be telling their stories and hoping to meet up with investors. So that's one of the things that we have a real bias. We have a bunch of institutional money in the room, and they'll do what they're going to do, and they have their own private meetings and, you know, big funds around this, and they'll do what they're doing. But we're enabling, because this market is real, we think this market is real, and we prove that it's big and it's growing, it's okay to fail. And there's almost not any second-generation entrepreneur, social entrepreneur. And so in Silicon Valley, the best entrepreneurs are on their second or third company, and they've hit a wall, and then they've learned from that and gone to the next one. So it's because it's real, then it's okay to fail, and we can fail forward. And so we have a bunch of these folks who will be pitching. Most of them will fail, but the next second or third one, they can be good. And so it's a civic duty in some sense to help the folks go forward, get enough money to go a little bit down the road, and some of them will make it, some of them will be really investable, and many of them will fail, but they will have learned a lot, and so the field will grow.
And this is one of the key aspects, right, of social capital, is that the traditional development environment mentality is the sort of waterfall funding thing where, you know, upstream foundations give money to downstream people, and eventually it sort of reaches the entrepreneur down in country. Mm-hmm. But you failed, and God forbid you should report that you failed, and then you're not going to get funded again. And so the lack of that mentality of being able to do fast failure, mm-hmm. capture your learnings, publish your learnings so that others don't make the same stupid mistakes, mm-hmm. and then get funded again to go do the right thing, mm-hmm. is actually one of the basic tenets of social capital, is you've mm-hmm. got to be able to have this Silicon Valley-like mentality that it's okay to do the wrong thing there and iterate really, really quickly and do the right thing over here.
Mm-hmm. So it's an agile process, like
right.
software.
Right, it needs mm-hmm. to be.
So Fiona, based on your track and your own experience, what are the different kinds of social capital that are available, and how do those affect the outcomes, and how will we find that out in your track?
So I think one of the great things about social enterprise, and I think it was really nicely expressed in the story about the entrepreneur coming from Pakistan, is that...
Can you inform me a little bit?
Sorry. Social enterprise draws upon all different kinds of capital. So it draws upon financial capital, for sure, which is our most flexible kind of capital. It draws upon natural capital. It draws upon social capital. And it delivers value in all of those places as well. So for that reason, it's kind of on the forefront of where business is going. And I think, so, you know, what we're going to explore in some of the tracks, particularly we have a track around slow money, and that is obviously talking about financial capital, but really tying it to a very different rhythm of how we actually do deals and how we actually look for returns. And obviously they're investing a lot in farming and in the communities to create a sort of a different connection with the natural capital around us, and actually acknowledging that that's actually the root of wealth and abundance and things that make life good. So that's one aspect. And then... I'm thinking also about the speakers from Steamer Systems who are here in the audience tonight, who are working in Kenya in a sort of post... So they were set up post-political unrest in the mid-90s. So they have a model of supplying solar chargers and creating a business model around that, so that what's happening there is it's leveraging entrepreneurial skills that are already in the community. Everybody there is already entrepreneurial. They don't need to learn how to do this. But this is actually a technology that's sort of transforming lives, because it allows people to liberate themselves from the search for firewood, the purchasing of kerosene, which has variabilities in price. And also bring social good into the communities, because people can not only start businesses, but they can actually then start to live differently, because they have access to energy in a much more stable form.
Okay, so Sarah, I saw you taking notes on that, so I'm interested in what your reaction is to what she had to say. But also, can you give us a preview of what people might learn from coming to... How many... Do you have 6 sessions during SoCal? Mm-hmm. Can you give us a preview, maybe, or tell us about... The first session that you were telling me about today with John Colco?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first session is going to look at the increased role of design in funded enterprise. So John Colco is a designer. He was a creative director at Frog, and he's now gone to a venture accelerator in Austin, and he's bringing in Gary Chu from Union Square Ventures, and Chris Diegelmeyer from Stanford Center for Social Innovation. And they're really going to talk about how in places where there's this venture capital environment or a lot of money's flowing, San Francisco and Austin, how much of that now is focused on enterprises that have designers as founders or co-founders, and kind of what that means. And what I was thinking about when Fiona was talking was the notion of capabilities and working with inherent capabilities within communities. I think some of the most interesting design that I'm seeing is using that as a starting point. I mean, it's not the old school kind of designers come in and, you know, design down upon a situation. It's designers are increasingly really good at getting a bunch of different people together when they're looking at a problem. If it's a community problem, is enlisting people from that community who know it better and their problems and their solutions actually better than anybody. And designers are really more facilitators of moving a process forward of, you know, understanding and breaking open a problem situation, looking at all different sides of it, exploring possibility, you know, designing new things. But it's, you know, starting with this point of looking at inherent human capabilities. And I think that's really beautiful. There's an Italian designer that I really like, Ezio Manzini, who has, some of you may know him, he's written quite a lot about this. He's a design researcher. And his watchwords are small, local, slow. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's really quite a lot to that.
Yeah, and I think just to... to sort of build on that, I think one of the really great things that I've sort of come to understand through curating this track around polycentrism as well, is that, you know, there's inherently a greater probability of cognitive diversity. So you have people with mm-hmm. expert knowledge because they're local, mm-hmm. and you bring enough strangeness into the system mm-hmm. with people with different ideas so that you get some new solutions, and you kind of broker really interesting conversations between all of that diversity. And there's a nice quote, which I'm just going to completely paraphrase, from Eleanor Ostrom, but she sort of says something along the lines that you need to have enough diversity in your solution space to match the diversity of the problem space. Mm-hmm. So the problems mm-hmm. are deep, knotty, complex, and you need to bring enough diversity in to really be able to meet them.
Mm-hmm. And for people who might not know who she is, I don't know if everybody does. I just learned about her a couple of years ago because Kevin started talking about her quite a lot. Maybe one of you two can give a little bit of background on her.
Sure. She won the Nobel Prize for her work in economics. And one of the things that she did is figure out that the commons is not often really a tragedy. So, like, in watersheds, if ranchers manage the watershed, they manage it well 70% of the time compared to government at 40% of the time if certain conditions exist, if there's transparent contracts and they have frequent random communication with each other. There was a really great data point today that relates to both of these mm-hmm. things put out by the Yale Forestry School, and they're the ones that are the big thought leaders on forestry. And they discovered that if it's a community-managed forestry resource, it's 6 times less likely to be deforested year over year than if it's a reserve that where the folks who own it said nobody can come in. So it's 6 times more effective forestry management if you actually have the local people do the management okay. compared to, you know, people from forestry school with MBAs and want to keep the people out. So there's this mm-hmm. you know local design yeah. You know it's if you care about the trees, the local people are 6 times better than an expert.
Mm-hmm. Could I have a question for the whole panel? I'm going to start with Gary, but can you explain, just to clarify the terms for people who may not be familiar with it, what exactly is impact investing as compared to investing for pure profit, and how can you best use this both in our modern Silicon Valley kind of world and also in the developing world?
Okay. So like any emerging arena, the labels sort of keep changing, and not everybody likes the labels, and people use the same labels for different things and different labels for the same things. And so you know, the richness of the English language is that we get to keep on changing it. So I think some people like the idea of you know, social capital and social entrepreneurs, and others who are sort of dyed-in-the-wool supporters of entrepreneurs think, well, there's no such thing as a social entrepreneur. You're just an entrepreneur. And if you're trying to have an impact, well, that's a separate thing. And so Jed Emerson, who was actually involved with this early group that Kevin and I were involved in called Capital Catalysts, and is sort of an early thinker of the double bottom line and the triple bottom line, you know, sort of laid out some of the different ways that you could have an impact. You could impact, you know, obviously the environment. You could have a positive social impact. And so there's been a lot of discussion about, well, what are you really asking a business to do? Are you asking a business to take on the tax of also doing good? And if you bake that in, well, then maybe the capital has to have lower expectations of what its return is going to be. And so the challenge, I think, for this arena has been to raise the quality of the entrepreneur and the company and the investment so that discount for good kind of goes away. And so when we first started looking at this arena back in 2000, I think it actually was a big challenge. You couldn't get a lot of people to think differently about the way to invest their money. You couldn't get entrepreneurs necessarily to be thinking about building great businesses. I used to make the distinction between a heart entrepreneur and a head entrepreneur. And a head entrepreneur is just going to build a great business. And if it had an impact as an ancillary result, that's great. And a heart entrepreneur is going to build a great nonprofit. And if it actually made, you know, a sustainable business, well, that was actually sort of a second order effect. And now I think what you're finding is that the quality of entrepreneurs is so much greater than when we first started looking at this arena. And the intentions of the capital are so much richer. People want to get more things out of the ways in which they invest. And there are more different ways that the sources of capital can partner to build in businesses that can have a positive impact. And so the whole mentality of building an impact business and having an impact investment, I think you're seeing the boats rise in both arenas.
Does that make sense to you? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kevin, do you want to follow up on that a little bit with how can people actually do this impact investing? Where do they start? I mean, obviously come to SoCap, but beyond that, I mean, how do we know? There's so much going on. How do we know between fair trade chocolate or buying something that seems overpriced from a third world country in a health food store to really making a difference in a company's or a country's infrastructure? Where do we start and how do we...
Where do you start? Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of people have started at Kiva. More people have started at Kiva.org because you see where your money goes. It's microfinance lending and it's no interest and you can see where your money goes. We're all partnered with MicroPlace, who is similar to that, but you actually get interest on that. And so we have a thing, and one of the reasons that we're really interested in local food and food deserts and things... And the folks at Slow Money, which is another group that's trying to put your money within 100 miles of where you are, is that there's a really interesting national campaign that MicroPlace is getting behind called Freshworks. And adding it up, lots of places are food deserts. Mostly poor places are food deserts, which means that it's mostly processed food. You can't find fresh vegetables. That equals a food desert within a region. They've got a way to fix that with for-profit grocery stores that was piloted in Philadelphia and then across Pennsylvania. That's now a national campaign. The California Endowment is putting $100 million behind it. And it's a way to put a market and some gardens and stuff in a poor neighborhood so that they and in their consumption habits and their social habits solve that problem, putting a lot of money behind it. But you can also do it, be involved in that for $20 through the MicroPlace app. And so we're actually going to have six people walking around with iPads who can, after you hear about the story, you can take action and put $20 in, and actually MicroPlace will match it. And so you can have... Put $20 up, you get $40. We want to have $100,000 that we've done, which may be deeply aspirational, probably is, at the end of the conference. But we are getting 1,500 people, and so we're giving everybody who does it another $20. So you can just take action right now, and you can point other people to it. So say you got $20, you can put $20 there, and you get your money back, and you get it with interest. But you're also transforming neighborhoods that we drive by, but we don't go into. And that's another whole way to connect right here in the U.S. that's pretty interesting.
Are there ways for corporate shareholders to use the SoCap principles to affect corporations and what they're doing?
Probably. You know, we are starting to work with some big corporates on things like they've done life cycle analysis of a laptop, and they figured out, you know, that mining selenium, most cell phones have selenium in them, you also have slavery in your wallet because there's slavery around selenium in Colombia. So they want to solve that problem because as people get to know it, you don't really... Do you have a slave-free phone or not? You're a little less hip if you have a slave-enabled phone in your pocket right now. So they want to solve that in a big way. And so they want experts to solve it, but they're going to work with us at the Hub, the co-working space we have down the street, and lots of entrepreneurs can try to throw some money at this problem and do some R&D around, you know, let's solve the slavery problem that we carry around in our cell phones. So they're starting to do it around research and development, around challenges, where they figured out not... Every cell phone has the selenium problem pretty much, you know. Every cell phone, you know, it's you got minutes and you got 3G and you got slavery in your phone.
Mm. This is not exactly that. But
as some would say, yeah.
We were talking earlier today about another form of social capital that we're going to experiment with at the conference. It's an alternative currency, and I think that's really interesting too, and just another dimension of what social capital means. Can you explain the currency?
Well, it's a pilot, but you know, the currency is just a representation of value, and then there's a lot of value that you get out of a conference. And so we're doing things like scoring panels, scoring speakers, and then see how it adds up. And next year we're going to really incorporate it because, you know, a currency is just a way you agree around a value and how it flows. And so I think we can, if people have a different agreement, then different value flows. And so it's a tool to enable people who want to change the world to create a way to put a different value on things. So I think it's got a lot of potential. It's a real small pilot, but I think it's got a lot of potential.
Okay, so Fiona, what from your experience, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about the other things that you do outside in the world as well, but why is social enterprise important now?
So I think social enterprise is important right now, right at this moment in history, because perhaps the obsession over the last 100 years with purely financial capital and the returns of that, and that kind of becoming disengaged from the other forms of capital is now looking very, very problematic for most people. So I think there's a real opportunity to actually see, and this is why I sort of said earlier that I think social enterprise is actually the sort of the new age of business. There's an opportunity now to sort of fold all of those other capitals in. Now, we know, you know, there's increasing talk, as Gary said earlier, about triple bottom line stuff, mm-hmm. and people bringing true cost accounting into business. And so, you know, solving for the slavery in your cell phone and all of those issues are only going to increase. So I think right now we just have this great moment where everything that we'd done previously and that sort of decoupling of financial capital from everything else is looking like a big failure, and now there's a big opportunity to do it differently.
Thank you. I'd like to let you know at this point we are going to turn it over for audience questions in just about a minute or two. There will be a microphone just over here to my left. We will have questions for about 15 minutes. We're restricted in time tonight because we are videotaping this program for broadcast. And if you can please ask your question at the microphone and keep it fairly succinct. But I have one last question for all you guys. Why now? Is it because they screwed it up so badly, or is it because we're evolving anyway? Or C, question mark.
Both.
Go ahead, Sarah. Why don't you start?
I just think both. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, my biggest question when you feel like you're at the inflection point of change is it a pendulum swing or is it a mutation? So mm-hmm. you know, we tend to go back and forth, especially in this country, between sort of strongly conservative leadership, strongly liberal leadership, and we tend to sort of go back and forth, in phases. And the question is not, you know, is it just side to side movement, but is it actually forward movement? And I believe we're sort of more in the mutation range. Is that there's a bunch of meta trends that are all sort of converging, mm-hmm. and what you hope is that it's going to be lasting change, sustainable change. And so these underlying mentalities that we're talking about, that business might have additional purpose, that pure financial return is not the only return. Is I think it's a meme that's catching on, and mm-hmm. it's actually you where you know it's going to actually have some sustainability is if businesses at scale are able to achieve sustainability and spawn other businesses at scale and so on and so on. It's Silicon Valley ecosystem exists because of a complex set of interactions, but basically the fact that you can keep on having the next wave of successful businesses spawn the next wave of successful businesses. And so I really do believe we're seeing the confluence of a number of these trends coming together, and it's not an artifact, it's not an accident that, mm-hmm. that these are tough economic times. The last time we went through this in the tech-fueled bust, Kevin and I had a really hard time convincing people that a lot of the ideas we're talking about today mattered. When we talked about, there's this whole idea of impact investing using the corpus of foundations, for instance. And 10 years ago, that was a joke, and now it's a movement. Mm-hmm. And so I really do believe that in these tougher economic times, when zero return is the new up, that you start to see a change in thinking, and that starts to get baked into the way people actually do things differently. Mm-hmm. So I really believe it's not a coincidence that you know, we're sort of riffling along at this tough economic times, and you've got 1,500 people coming to SoCap.
Yeah, and I think just to add to that sort of inflection point, whether we go back to the pendulum or we move forward, is up to each of us.
Right.
Kevin?
Well, and we also have the gift of climate change and the coming gift of peak oil that will keep this mm-hmm. from being a fad.
Sarah?
Yeah, it's all true.
There you go.
Okay, that's a designer.
I'm not happy.
Okay, we'll turn it over now for our first audience question. If you would like to come up to the microphone, please.
I think what I heard tonight was you're trying to instill open-mindedness in across all fields. Will your platform work in politics? And have you thought about applying your platform to politicians who seem to be brain dead? who just don't seem to get it. Have you given that any thought? And is it...
No.
Would it work? And would it might work.
I doubt it. The State Department fell in love with us after SOCAP 10, and they announced SOCAP at State. And then actually what they wanted to do was a summit. And when you say it's a summit, that just means who's in the room and how much power do they have and where do they sit. And they still haven't come up with the actual time and date of the summit. So I don't see much happening.
Gary?
Yeah, I got up at 2 a.m. our time this morning in Washington, D.C., so we're doing a couple projects there. So it's sort of top of mind. And if you contrast inside the Beltway with inside Silicon Valley as two different ecosystems where you've got a lot of similar characteristics. You've got a lot of different players, a lot of power, a tremendous amount of money, a lot of initiatives, and a lot of people trying to accomplish something. You've got two completely different sensibilities as to how those ecosystems operate. And I'm not saying Silicon Valley is perfect. I'm not saying it's the only model that matters. But I believe that ecosystem, at least at this point in time, is fundamentally broken. And the only way that you're going to be able to have an impact there is if you go off and you create collaborative platforms in other arenas, and many of them focusing on the kind of wicked problems that Fiona is talking about, that can infuse the thinking inside the Beltway, but it doesn't need to be part of it. It's the only way I can see, because there is such a negativity in D.C., and this should be a period of time when it should be really positive. I mean, you've got a new election cycle coming in, and people should be looking towards the future, and it's exactly the opposite. Whereas if you were to walk around SOCAP next week, you will, I guarantee you, realize that you're meeting some of the most amazing people in the world or having some of the most incredible impacts in the ways in which we think and the ways in which we can act. And it's because it's a new ecosystem. It's not because it's building off of the old one.
Yeah, we bring together people who want to do things and want to meet together. And with politics, you have to deal with people who are not in the room and you want them to do something they don't want to do. And I'd rather do the former.
Okay, our next question.
Hi, my name's Peter Gisella. I work in a hospital laboratory for like 40 years, so I'm always in awe when I have an opportunity to speak or talk with experts that survive in the social capital world. Related to his question, next week President Obama is going to be talking about money, meaning, and jobs. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that SOCAP and the discussions you're going to do next week could highlight some of the things he should be bringing attention to the Congress and to the nation should be focused on in order to facilitate a much bigger expansion in your endeavors? And my second question is, along the lines of design, I was in the Air Force during the Yom Kippur War and experienced the OPEC oil embargo and concluded that we needed a youth energy corps. And in San Jose, a congressman proposed challenging youth between 17 and 18 to consider doing some form of contracted community service or military service. And I proposed this energy corps to counterbalance a future war in the Persian Gulf. And nobody's interested in it, both liberals and conservatives. Capitalists and nonprofits seem to disagree with even doing a what-if model on this. And I would like to share this with you afterwards.
Is there a question there?
Yeah, well, the question was about Obama and your conference next week. Is your conference going to highlight anything that
Fiona, why don't you start this one? I'll give you a wicked problem to solve.
Yeah, but I'm all on my own. No, I'm not. I have four people here with me. Because I've been thinking about the local aspect to all of this for the last few months, I think a lot of the things that we need to do and we need to take care of are the things that we can do immediately by walking around our neighborhoods and looking at the things that need to be fixed there. Now, that doesn't solve the jobs problem in a big way, and I think a lot of the anticipation around the speech next week is going to be thinking about a big solution to a big problem, and I'm not sure the big solution is the one that we need. I think there's something else that has to happen.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I see a lot in the work of Code for America. I mean, they're going around broken government systems that don't work and redesigning systems that do. And they have people who will want to engage with them. And then again, there's some people in government, like here in San Francisco, Jay Nath, is involved in government. He's really a proponent of open source and has done a lot to work with entrepreneurs and technologists who want to build stuff, see, click, fix, where you can, you know, post local problems and get them solved. And I mean, they're so, but I think it's small scale. Again, it's small scale. It's like kind of looking for the interstitial spaces between broken things that you can fix with a small groups of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then, like, the data from forestry says communities are six times better than centralized management by experts. So I think it's also more efficient than a centralized government answer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and also, I think, again, speaking of macro trends, and I think playing off of the question about government, and I apologize for being so negative just because it's very much top of mind as to how broken the system is. As Kevin mentioned, I'm launching a business with several partners focused on the work of What Color Is Your Parachute? And it just so happens that one of my business partners is my father, who's the author. And so we actually have had this conversation recently exactly on this topic, what's really broken fundamentally from a job standpoint. And what happened in the past is that the government would step into periods like this, and the government would actually take on three or four different roles. It would hire, it would provide economic incentives to hire, it would do public works projects, it would do a variety of things to try to change the landscape, the economic landscape, to sort of kickstart a lot of things. The government's not going to do that. It's not going to happen this time. Obama can't do that because the pendulum swing is towards reducing the debt and trying to take a lot of government out of a lot of the programs that in the past it would have funded. And so one of the memes I think is going to arise out of this is that this is the era of self-reliance. Mm. It's the era of the entrepreneur. And really what the government needs to do is do more to incent individuals to be able to learn about the skills and values that they have and the ways to find their own work and to create their own jobs. It needs to be able to incent entrepreneurs, and I think more and more social entrepreneurs, to be able to have greater impact and to be able to have access to the capital that they need. But it's not going to be a top-down model. We're not in that era anymore. It needs to be in a model where individuals are empowered to be able to make their own change. And I think that's one of the consistent themes we've had with SOCAP all along.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly why I addressed that. Okay, thank you. I'm afraid we can't hear you on the radio, so we're going to go to the next question, and there will be time for this question and then one more, and then we will be out of time for this evening. So I would like to go to the next question, please.
It sounds like SOCAP is really good at bringing people with ideas together, sitting them down in a room and taking a new problem and building a solution from the ground up, or designing a solution. But I guess my question for you is, how can SOCAP take existing large corporations and really nudge them towards employee engagement and really not just getting a philosophy that's written on their website down, but really getting people in the company every day to kind of be doing the right things and teaching that mentality so that they're willing to move on and do that themselves?
Yeah, well, I think just to one response to that. So in our work, we do a lot of, in collective invention, we do a lot of work with big corporations as well as nonprofits and other kinds of entities. And what we found more and more is that there are more people within big corporations who really want to change things. You know, we sort of do a lot of work with sustainability directors and people in CSR who just really want to take that somewhere completely different than what corporate social responsibility used to be. So I think there's almost like a polycentrism that needs to happen inside corporations. Mm. And I don't know that I don't know that SOCAP is an entity that's going to make that happen, but I do think it could be an inspiration or a source of some kind of support or community or something to make that happen.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, we're really about and founded on disruptive innovation, and what people talk about government or big corporations, you're talking about being incremental change agents. Mm-hmm. It's a really good thing. We're not that, and so we don't confuse ourselves. We enable the entrepreneur, and we enable the next stage and expansion phases up to $10 million to even $100 million deals. But we're about fast-moving capital to make a change, partnering with foundations, partnering with government to the extent we can. But we're not about incremental change of any big entity. That's a great thing. That's not us.
Okay, unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where we have time for only one more question. Our program tonight is Social Capital, the Intersection of Money and Meaning, Part 2. And now our last question.
Thank you. I was surprised to see the heavy role of design in the conference. And my initial thought was design is appropriate for non-essential products. And my second thought was the people at the base of the pyramid that are consuming products and services wrap their lives around it. It's the central part of their life. What is the result? What is the role for design for products and services that are consumed at the base of the pyramid?
I think it's critical. And it's critical that they function properly for the people they're intended to serve. I mean, you look at something like a Life Straw, you know, which had a great intention, but, you know, it was a device that made people kneel down and suck through a straw, you know, dirty water in puddles, and people didn't want to do that. You know, it was a bad design, and so it was intended to help people purify water, but it didn't work. Mm-hmm. It didn't achieve its aim. So I think, you know, that's a design flaw, and it's a failure to serve the people. So getting it right is critical.
Just to piggyback on that, I think the mentality to me that resonates the most is design as it comes from in-country and from the needs of people, from the local, the knowledge of local people,
right,
as to the problems that need to be solved. C.K. Prahalad, the co-author of Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, was a friend, and we definitely mourn his passing. But he was really one of the first people to talk about, and he never used the word design, I think, in the entire book, but his underpinning was that the design of products that are done in-country is so much greater advantages. It's not a bunch of us, well-meaning people coming from richer nations imposing design ideas on what we think is going to solve a problem. You know, the fossil record is littered with well-intentioned projects like that. What you really want to do is to enable people who are trying to solve local problems to use design thinking to be able to solve them. And what CK was really brilliant at saying is once they've solved those problems, in many cases, those products and those solutions are going to come back here because they'll be far more competitive. Mm-hmm. They're products that are much better suited to be able to solve problems at low cost but at great scale. And that's really what you're starting to see is that more of that innovation is coming back here. That's really the kind of design thinking that I think is going to have the biggest impact.
Mm-hmm.
I can illustrate that with two products actually in your area. I think you'd find interesting. This is a little bracelet for One Degree Solar, which is a really cool startup. It's a solar lantern and an FM radio. And they have this great innovation where when you buy it in an African small village store, you put in the serial number but also the number of the store and you text it. And that starts warranty stuff happening. That starts repair stuff happening. It starts a huge, valuable data stream around the SMS that you start knowing things. The problem with it is it adds to the cost because these are people who can't quite buy the full product and you're adding on the layer of service and quality around it. And so, you know, Gaurav hasn't gotten funded, but Simpa, which is another tech startup that formed at SoCap, it's really cool. It's for people who can't afford solar by, as a product. Even if they get their family together, they can't buy the LEDs and the panels and stuff, but they could buy it by the week or the minute. And so Simpa is a wireless connection that's like a utility. And so everybody's costs go down because the cost of solar is 30% less than kerosene and remove something that kills 1.5 million people. But their costs go down, but they even go down below that because they're only paying by the minute. It becomes a great business because you're always going to pay it, but your costs go down. And so there's bad design. In solar and renewable energy in the developing world, you have to solve payment and you have to solve repair and you have to solve maintenance. And if you don't solve that right, then you don't solve a problem and you don't have a real business.
Okay, well, thank you. We're just about out of time. I'd like to give each of our panelists just a couple of sentences about a Twitter for the panel, maybe a few more than 140 characters. But if you could just give us, each of you, give us a closing statement or two, starting with Gary on my end, and then we'll work the way down the panel.
Yeah, I already feel like I've dominated the microphone too much, so I think I've made my views fairly well known, so I think I'll just give Fiona my extra time.
Great.
You took up your time with that statement, actually.
Yeah, you did.
I knew that.
So all I would say is that local is really important, and each one of us has the capacity to make differences.
Yeah, I think I'll say something like that. I think the way to solve a global problem is with lots of little specific solutions everywhere. And the alternative is to have big systemic heart-freezing NPR analysis where you look at big problems and you don't know the way out. Yeah, there's a lot of small things you can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just I hope you all come to SOCAP and experience that the importance of, you know, bumping up against people that you wouldn't ordinarily meet and getting perspectives that really allow you to see things in a new way and kind of put some pieces together that might not have been there before.
Okay, thank you, everyone. Our program tonight has been Social Capital, the Intersection of Money and Meaning, Part 2. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum. The Business and Leadership Forum has sponsored our program for tonight. I'd like to thank our panelists, Fiona Hovenden, Kevin Jones, Gary Bowles, and Sarah Brooks. And with this, I'd also like to thank our audience for attending and our audience listening at home. And with this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.